The pathway to this conversation started some weeks ago when we had for a while been in kind of early Mahayana Bodhisattva teachings, and we were talking about emptiness. And I got on, I said, this often happens, you know, 9:15, end of a question, last minute of the thing. And I think I said something like, of course, you can go through either the emptiness doorway or the fullness doorway. And if skillfully practiced, they can both lead to the insight into the conditioned nature of experience and the emptiness of the self, liberation. Like they can both go there if you use them skillfully enough. And then, of course, you know, a bunch of y'all, you know who you are, said, fullness, that's my thing. And so then we were like, okay, let's talk about fullness. And with fullness, I think that really means talking about a collection of ideas that are very beloved in contemporary Buddhist circles in the West, and differently beloved in some Asian source traditions, that suggest that the heart of the Dharma has something to do with the perception of everything being interconnected, interwoven, all one process. And therefore that perceiving or resting in the mystical contact with, the mindful contact with the fullness or the effulgence of things points one toward a liberating experience, liberating insight. Interconnectedness as the heart of the Dharma. So this turns out to be actually a pretty difficult claim historically and philosophically. And so last week we looked at the early origins of ideas of interdependence and fullness. And the pathway to that is from the early Buddhist teachings on karma and dependent origination, where there's really a recognition that sensory contact and intentional action give rise to results, particularly rebirth in fortunate or unfortunate circumstances, depending on the ethical valence of the action. So your actions matter, particularly for yourself, in terms of where you go next in this cycle of rebirth. And that liberation consists in no longer committing actions, particularly the inward emotional actions of fixating the sense of self and identity that keep one bound to perpetual rebirth. You let go of unskillful, unethical action so fully that there's no craving left to inspire more births. There's nothing left you need to do. And so you stop re-arising, right? This is an amazing metaphysics that proposes that rebirth is not just an ecosystem process, but actually the way that sentience or consciousness finds itself embodied is the result of that consciousness being infected by an ancient habit of craving, such that it wants to be embodied. It wants further birth. And so it commits actions that make that further birth happen, primarily not having let go. So continuing to want, continuing to crave, continuing to lust, continuing to hunger, gives rise to continuing to be conscious. And then working through those drives for endless, you know, cosmic eons. Then along come the Buddhas, and the Buddha says, it's profoundly simple. Stop doing that. and your life changes radically into this extraordinary way of being where you don't need anything in a craving, in a constricted kind of way. You continue to be alive and actually quite happy, because all the anxieties and the neuroses of complaining about how painful the world is and wanting things to be better fall away. And there's a kind of ongoing maturity that he called being awake. And that from that state of ongoing maturity, you have your life to live in a way that's unbound from personal constrictions, personal narrative. And what's left then is compassionate engagement, is really the choice to use your life's energies for the well-being of others. And that's freedom in the early Buddhist sense. Then come the Mahayana mystics who contact in deep meditation states of profound dissolution, profound dissolving of the body, the narrative, the sense of self, the sense of space and time collapsing into radiant, ecstatic, unitive seeming states. And in unitive seeming states, there can be the perception that everything, every kind of sentient being, every kind of material substance, the full extendedness of the universe can all be understood as a singular process unfolding that's completely impersonal, radically one connected thing. That's what it feels like in those meditations. If you make that into a metaphysics, you could come out and say, that's one way of understanding what's true. Everything is one scintillating web of aliveness. And so that gives rise to Mahayana images, extraordinary meditative and mystical images like the net of Indra, a kind of a grid-like matrix that fills the entirety of existence, where strands of energy or beingness intersect innumerable times, and at every intersection is a glistening gem, like a perfectly round drop of pure water that is so lucid, so clear, that it reflects, as a drop of water does, every drop around it. So in everything can be seen, if you can see clearly enough, the reflection of everything. So that's Huayan, Chinese Mahayana philosophy, that comes out as the net of Indra. And that's really still an individual mystical perception. The Huayan were not social activists. They were still searching for a kind of liberation based in accessing these profound states and understanding non-separateness, and therefore beginning to understand karma and conditionality differently. Because instead of just like my ethical or unethical actions conditioning my next rebirth, this much more blown out metaphysics suggests that if you can see every other node in the web in every node, the actions of every node must affect every other node. And therefore, karma and ethical action becomes a kind of non-dual, impersonal, infinitely extended process. So then you start to say, oh, the conditions that lead to this moment, my happiness or unhappiness in this moment, are only in some minuscule way dependent on, my ethical or unethical actions earlier this morning. And instead, they must be, this moment must be the sum total of all the conditions of all the moments in all the universes that have ever already happened. And of course, time is an illusion in this understanding as well, because past, present, and future are just more nodes of perspective in that web. And so this moment then becomes shot through with the vibrant beingness and actionness of every other moment in every other universe everywhere. right? So this is a marvelous, radically non-dual, mystical perspective. And I think if we can contact that, if we have enough concentration and supportive conditions to rest in those states, even to touch into them a little bit, it's freeing. It's overwhelming if we try to grasp at any aspect of it, but it's freeing in those meditations, because that perspective will wipe out any neurotic narrative you got running. It all just blows out. So let's fast forward almost 2,000 years from the Huayan Buddhists, maybe 1,500 years from them. And in the 19th century, when Buddhism began to be, and Buddhist texts began to be first translated by European colonialists, and the Asian Buddhist cultures were in their really the full bloom of colonial contact with the British and the Dutch and the French, but in terms of Southeast Asian Buddhism, primarily the British, in Burma and India, of course, and the French in what's now Vietnam, and beloved Thailand resisting colonial occupation but being surrounded on all sides, and then the ancient Chinese Empire, you know, like humming to the north. You know, resisting the colonial force in a different way. In the 19th century, these texts start to arrive in Europe and get translated. And some of the first people to notice their profundity are European philosophers. Hegel notices, a bunch of the kind of 19th century romantics in Germany. The German romantics begin to notice. You know, this is Goethe and Schilling and their descendants. And into the 19th century, we start to get interpretations of early translations of these texts, and almost nobody is practicing. There's one or two people that have gone to India and Burma and Thailand to practice. A couple of them just disappear there and never come back. There's an Irish vagabond criminal that might have been the first Burmese monk, and she just kind of disappears into, you know, like boards a ship in the Dublin harbor running away from the law. And the next time he appears, he's either a charlatan or an authentically devotional Buddhist monk who is also like giving political speeches against the British occupation of Burma. What, and, you know, like that's happening. It's really wild out there in the late 19th century. So there's a little bit of practitioner contact, but there's more text contact. And what happens with that first text contact is the German romantics and very soon the North American transcendentalists, so Ralph Waldo Emerson, Thoreau, and then later John Muir, start to get their hands on early translations of these texts. And suddenly the romantic idea that nature, this is German romanticism, 19th century, nature shows to us, if we know how to immerse ourselves in it, the divinity of all things that we've lost contact with through the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution and through rational modernism, meaning Renaissance, rational enlightenment. We've lost touch. We've opened to some humanistic ideals, but God is dying. Pace Nietzsche, God is dead, right? The old Christianity isn't working. And so what we take from Christianity is an idea that there was a primal rightness, a goodness in the natural world before human sin. So we ride the biblical narrative of the fall from Eden into an idea that you can escape from the dirty industrial cities, you know, if you're an independent, self-made, you know, man almost entirely in that era. And, you know, do you know that great painting, The Wanderer Above the Mists? It's the most famous German romantic painting. One guy in a big overcoat standing on a cliff looking over an enormous valley, you know. And so you see this in you know, in images of, you know, the solitary mystical wanderer who's kind of a middle-class layperson, essentially, who goes out to nature and rediscovers himself. I'm going to leave that in the gendered him for the 19th century at the moment. Although there's a different strand of it developing that comes, you know, through you know, Mary Wollstonecraft and Mary Shelley and others. But it's not romanticism in the same way. There's actually a critique that those authors are bringing, that the male romantics don't buy initially. The male romantics really bring forward this like individual, rugged nature mystic. And so this makes it over to North America, and we get Emerson writing the book Nature, and we get Thoreau, and they're really talking about going out into the woods, in Thoreau's case, essentially Emerson's backyard, more or less, but, you know, going out into the woods and contacting the beauty and the transcendent realness of being in contact with the natural world. And then they've started to read some Buddhist and Hindu texts in translation, and they start to connect this with nirvana. They start to connect this with a mashup of liberation ideas and these later Zen ideas that start to really take hold. And this just keeps developing. So, you know, you get John Muir looking out at Yosemite and writing about how his sense of self falls away completely, and he's one with the seeing, and the seeing dissolves, and everything unfolds into one radiant suchness. And you can trace the lineage of that kind of thinking. Like, his insight is authentic. He's a nature mystic. That's a real state he's describing. But the language he uses to describe it comes from this lineage that goes back into the transcendentalists, and then from there is influenced by the Romantics and by Dharma, by the Asian Dharmas. So by the time we get into the 20th century, we start to really hear more and more about this concept of interdependence and interconnectedness as being the heart of the Dharma. What European and American Buddhist communities are hearing is really a blend now between these Western post-Christian and post-Jewish, right? Jason says, you know, Spinoza, God equals nature. That's a very much part of that same thread. So Spinoza in the Jewish vein, the German Romantics in the Christian vein, Alfred North Whitehead and process philosophy in the British. And you eventually will get someone like Joanna Macy. Blessings to Grandmother Joanna, still with us, and teaching, going back to the early Buddhist texts, right? She starts in Sri Lanka, and she's writing about the interpretation of dependent origination there. And she's really spinning out a connection between, she's actually tracing it back to the early system to say, essentially, can we use the framework of dependent origination? Ethical action gives rise to results. Can we use this as a supportive framework for an activist life, for a life of engagement? And she does this really interesting thing, which is she draws on not just the Net of Indra and the Huayan and Chinese interdependence thing, which she totally does. She traces it back to the Pali Canon and straight dependent origination also. But then she does this romantic thing, as she brings in the fall of man. She brings in the myth of the Garden of Eden as a way to talk about the loss of a primordially pure state and the arrival in this fallen state. And then she'll make, like many modern Buddhist thinkers, she'll then equate samsara, the endless round of suffering and rebirth, with the fall. So the state of being fallen is the state of being in samsara. Now, in a classical Buddhist metaphysics, this makes no sense. In a modernist Buddhist metaphysics, we can see its lineage. And it makes sense in the way that we can feel the myth of the fall in a way that moves something in the heart for folks of cultures raised with that myth. So I'm going to say we because my ancestors are primarily Spanish and English, so Catholic and Episcopalian, Christian. If you're from a tradition like the Asian traditions that doesn't have the fall as your core concept, then you can take this whole talk as an anthropological talk about very strange people in the post-Christian West who have done some things with the Dharma. That's the history I'm telling. For those folks who are descended from those European romantics and the North American transcendentalists and the post-Christian pantheists who were really looking during the colonial period for a theology that would make sense of the world that was being, in which the old orders were being broken down so radically. And this approach actually speaks, I think, in a beautiful way to many of those anxieties, the anxieties that come through the colonial period and the beginning of the postmodern climate collapse period. And so what interdependence and fullness does in a modernist sense is that it offers us, I think, this is my attempt at an integration, it offers us an attempt at a religious or metaphysical understanding of existence and our place in the universe that is coherent with deep ecology, globalism, an understanding of the complex system of the planet and how everything in a climate rupture world is connected. It's coherent with that in a way that the ancient, more individually and locally oriented, you know, suffering is what happens when you are out of sync with, you know, the basic drives of your animal being in a way, you know, in relation to craving, like interdependence and fullness speaks to the global consciousness that many of us find ourselves immersed in, oppressed by, tortured by, inspired by, and unable to escape. So I think it's a very helpful metaphysic for that, in a way that the early Buddhist system just doesn't speak to. The early Buddhist system recognizes that if you want to be free, you have to deal with craving and fixated identity somehow. The challenge in the interdependence and fullness approach, one of the challenges, some of the challenges there, are that they usually work by suggesting an alternate identity from the fixated individual one, which it recognizes as harmful, right? Into identifying with more of like a sum of all beings, or identifying with the ecosystem or the everything that is here. I think this identify, and this comes out in, for instance, you know, the urge to save this planet of ours because we love it, because it's our home, because we love the animals and plants and people and spirits that make it home, and we don't want to extinct species and, you know, bring about more suffering. I think that completely beautiful and appropriate ethical and moral stance right now depends mostly, or for many of us, I think, depends on some amount of identifying with life on this planet. And so from an early Buddhist perspective, that's still identity, and it's going to be constricting. There's craving there. But we need a metaphysic that can speak to the current crisis. And I think this is one that can. It runs a danger of fixated identity. It runs a danger of not actually fully addressing craving. Because in a way, for this myth or narrative to be helpful, we have to actually maintain some cravings within it. This is why the activists always ask, how can I work for liberation and still work for social justice or for, you know, environmental, you know, sustainability or improvement? And, you know, the standard answer is always that compassionate action doesn't depend on craving for its motivation. But that's theoretical. And a lot of us, to be honest, really do depend on craving of various sorts for our motivations. You know, I work hard because I want things. And so I don't want to preach something that's not possible to do. And so I think one of the things that's just beautiful about the interdependence teaching, first of all, is that I think from a non-dual or mystical perspective, I'm going to say true, but what I mean by that is skillful. The perception of the interconnectedness of things is a profound state. It goes way back. I think it is implied in the early texts, and it's certainly well-rooted in the mystical strand of Mahayana that grew into Zen and Chan and the Vajrayana and Dzogchen and a lot of other things. So that perception has a long pedigree and has been well vetted. The thing that doesn't have a long pedigree is this mashup with individualist romanticism and nature mysticism. And so I think as a practice, the pathway might look something like this. The core practice is the same: mindfulness, loving kindness, concentration, and investigation of experience. So I figure out how to get a little less distracted, or a lot. I direct my attention at ongoing experience, which by definition is coming through the senses, so it's individual. I understand this as bearing out in the teachings on radical difference and positionality. I know that I perceive the world differently than you do and that anyone does, because our base conditions are different. Just that alone should be enough to live a life of tolerance and kindness and generosity and non-hatred. That going further than that, this investigation of things classically would emphasize seeing the impermanence of things and therefore the emptiness of meaning, but can, I think, just as easily be framed as a kind of ecstatic appreciation of the fullness of existence without losing any of that insight that is necessary for liberation. I hope this is true. I think this is true. Can you, let me know what you think about this, can you perceive the world around you as full in a way where there's some appreciation, right? Not just full like, wow, so much suffering, but full like, wow, there's beauty and you know, complexity and interrelatedness and sexiness. Like this is the Eros side of perceiving the world. Differently from the Thanatos, the death drive, like subtract, 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 subtract. This is the everything is radically full way of perceiving. Can we do that? Be in that kind of state and still grow the insight into impermanence and selflessness? And I think we can, because those things are just true. They're going to show themselves no matter what. The fullness of things doesn't mean things last. I think the path is something like, I can appreciate the extraordinary beauty and effulgence of something I'm observing and know that it's fleeting, right? And there's beautiful metaphysics now in the modern period where it's like the fleetingness itself is a kind of beauty, right? The Zen folks were brilliant at this, right? Seeing the autumn leaves fall, knowing that nothing lasts, right? Like, and it's just, you know, like the garden is the source of all wisdom. There's such a beauty you know, the appreciation, you know, our friend Rebecca has waxed gorgeously on this, the appreciation of the dying flower, right? The petals drying up and crumbling off. You know, one of my favorite jobs in the garden is tending the compost, is like turning the stinky kitchen scraps and the dead flowers and all the rest into like rich loam, you know, and it's just magic. You put it all together, you stack it the right way, you chant some incantations, and 3 months later you turn it over and it's full of little pill bugs, and you can just like sift the brown earthiness through your fingers. How does that work? And then you put it in your beds and your tomatoes are fatter and plumper and more glorious. That's interconnectedness, you know, in the modern nature mystic kind of way, right? So I think our task in relating in a wholesome way to these discourses I think it's always good to do the deconstruction, understand where they came from, know what's what historically, because that's just good practice. But then in internal practice, the inquiry is something like, given the beauty and the extraordinary fullness of the world, what is right relationship with this? How can I be in right relationship with this? And right relationship is going to have to mean liberating relationship, because if I'm not liberated, I'm fixating the small self. I'm going to act in ways that are small-minded or unethical or at least deluded, because there's not clarity. What I need, want, must have, must practice toward is clarity. And so seeking clarity can be interwoven in every aspect of this, right? And so I think I want to loop it back, and I'll finish here back in the early Mahayana, and say, I think that this whole modernist trend, you know, even with the post-Christian, you know, romantic business, I think it's not that far off the early Mahayana. It adds some European elements. The Dharma always morphs when it goes to new cultures. When all of this interdependence anyway is in large part a result of the influence of indigenous Chinese Taoism on the Buddhism that arrived there. Buddhism didn't arrive in China as a nature mysticism, but it became that when it met the Taoists, who were, you know, brewing liqueurs and riding dragons through the clouds. So, you know, and you know, sitting on the cliff, observing the mountain until only the mountain remains. And so I think that there's actually a beautiful, and the intuition that Emerson and Thoreau and Muir had that drew on those texts, I think that in a way I'm down with them being the spiritual ancestors of the, you know, of Huang Po and the, you know, the Huayan non-dualists. And, you know, if we lose ourselves in the image of interconnectedness, we can fall away from the practice of discernment. And so that's the edge that I think this practice walks here, is that we can go too far in the direction of romanticism and actually lose the cutting through that the practice of the uprooting of craving really requires. All right, thanks for sticking with that. It's a couple minutes over. I kept wanting to stop, but I couldn't not try to draw it back to the positive. I didn't want to stop right in the middle of saying, you know, Buddha good, colonial bad, because, you know, it's too easy. So, and not enough. So as we do always, when I talk like this, I'm going to stick around for a few minutes. I would love to hear questions or responses. If this is your time to say goodnight, I'll do a closing dedication here, and then I'll stick around for Q&A if you want. I have no deadline tonight because my wife is on retreat. I'm free. And my kid is at a sleepover. So we can go all night if you want it. All right. mean, all beings in all realms, human, non-human, above, below, in all directions, swimming, flying, walking, running, appearing spontaneously in realms of effulgent energy. May all beings rest in the great peace beyond confusion. May we know our place in the order of things, and may our intention for well-being radiate through every pore of our being and all the pores of all the beings interwoven in a great web. May all beings find their way toward more and more peaceful lives together. May all the wars end. May we grow up as a species, as a collective, enduring and working with samsara. And may all beings everywhere be liberated. Blessings and gratitude. Good night to anyone bouncing.